Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, or whenever you happen to be listening to this, welcome to the Film Realist Podcast, the film and TV podcast from a complete nobody. That is hopefully for somebody. My name is Kyle Naranya, and welcome to episode 205, where on this week's episode, I will be reviewing Spider-Noir, the Nicolas Cage-led Spider-Man Noir series on Prime Video. As the whole series is now out, full spoilers, you have been warned. Time codes will be listed in the description should you want to hop around. And why not get into our black and white settings, because it's time to swing around 1930s New York with my Spider-Noir review.
Been a while.
You've done well without me around, haven't you?
Didn't know you did hit jobs now. Do you mind if I ask you who hired you?
Nobody hires me. I'm here because of Ben Reilly.
Reilly the Flatfoot?
Yeah, that's right. I owe him a favor.
Sorry, where are my manners? Do you want a drink?
No! I want you and your goons to lay off Reilly.
Before diving fully into my review of Spider-Noir, the first place and the most obvious is, how did I watch the show? Now, I've watched the trailers in the true hue colors, as well as authentic black and white. And while I really love the high contrast of the true hue color version, because this is the 1930s, and of course based on our introduction to a version of this character in the theatrical films of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse and Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, I chose to watch this in black and white. And in my humble opinion, that is the way that you have to watch this show. I think that you don't really get to appreciate what they're truly going for with the pulpy noir 1930s depression era setting. Not to mention, this helps set it apart from so many other superhero medias. One of the most entertaining and visually captivating elements of the Spider-Verse films and any Spider-Man genre, really, is that it's always very colorful. And immediately when watching this in black and white, you are set up for a very different experience. The pacing of the story, the performances, some of the visual effects, the visual language of this series is set up like at it is as if it was made in that era. Obviously, you have a Spider-Man swinging around, incredible action sequences, but it would appear from everyone working on this, and if you know anything about Nicolas Cage, he is a longtime lover of cinema, a true fan, and what inspired this is everything from that era, whether that be the accents, the setting, the sets, the way in which those narratives would unfold. What would a Private Eye story be like if we were doing a 1930s Spider-Man story? Not as if we're time traveling, we're telling a story from that era. And there's no tongue-in-cheek, look at this, isn't it really funny? A lot of this has to be done with pure authenticity, having everybody be invested into delivering that kind of story. And they do. It's so specially unique and unlike so many other things, where so much of superhero media now is much more into the tongue-in-cheek, the meta-commentary, where this definitely has applicable commentary on the political climate and what was happening within the Depression is reflective of certain elements of society today, but not in a way where it feels like that's fundamentally part of the story. It is naturalistically woven into the story being told through these 8 episodes. So we're following Ben Reilly as the Spider. Something that I would love to know, and it's purely from a copyright standpoint, is are Prime Video not allowed to use the word Spider-Man and or Peter Parker? Because this does set this Spider-Man noir apart from the one that was introduced in the Spider-Verse films. That was a Peter Parker, and this is essentially Spider-Man noir adjacent because it is Nicolas Cage in his first television role of all time. And it's so fantastic. I don't think you can understate why this show doesn't work unless it's Nicolas Cage, because he feels as if he is one of those actors from the 30s that plays up the subtlety when required, but also can just go to 11, being as big and bold and just overacting in a way that this series understands when it is most effective in trying to tell this story about a washed-up superhero. That's one of those elements that I find so fascinating, because there's been this criticism with some of our heroes returning to the screen, whether that be Luke Skywalker or Indiana Jones, that they are over the hill and they are no longer the hero that we once knew. And this series' perspective and point of view on Ben Reilly as a hero is after tragedy. He's no longer Spider. I'm just going to call him Spider-Man. I know he's the Spider. He's given up that mantle after the death of a loved one. So it puts him in this place of sorrow. And what's so funny about watching this series, knowing what the Spider-Verse films focused on, which was the canon and events that have to happen, a canon event that outline all of Spider-Man's histories across the entire Spider-Verse. We saw the death of a mentor, the death of a loved one. Those are fundamental things, canon events, that have to happen in a Spider-Man story. And even though this is not the exact version that we saw earlier in the Spider-Verse films, those things still have happened to an older Spider-Man. He had had his powers after World War I, being a prisoner of war in a POW camp. And Ben hates having powers. The loss of his ruby has forced him, not forced him, I guess, but he has chosen to give up being Spider-Man. And because of that, he is in this space that is very familiar to a lot of Spider-Man fans. If you've watched any of the live-action films, and in the upcoming Spider-Man Brand New Day, we are used, in live-action at least, to seeing Spider-Man in the down in the dumps. People talk about the sad boy era, and now we're getting that with the sad man era from Nicolas Cage. And this allows his version of Ben Reilly, a character that's not been adapted a ton, of course introduced as a concept in the Clone Saga, and a great legal way of not having to name somebody Peter Parker. But he is that private eye. He's bumbling through life, not really doing the things he's meant to do. He says at the end of the series, and we get part of this as kind of the main focus of his story, which is, if you don't have the power, you don't have any of the responsibility. Ben hates the idea that he has these powers because he does not want that responsibility anymore. And it's only when he is accidentally thrust into a mystery. And the show, for the most part, is split up into two main stories. The first half really focuses on Silvermane and Brendan Gleeson playing that character in a way where it feels perfectly pitched from something in that era. He gets to use his natural accent, something that would fit so perfectly in a 1930s New York. And we see the mystery unfolding that is going on with these supervillains. And what's I really appreciated about the way that they tell this story is there's a tragedy to these powers. They are portrayed much more like movie monsters, movie monster serials from that era, the horrors of the superpowers. And they're not played for spectacle. It is tragic that they have these abilities, that they have prevented them from becoming part of society. And they come on as if it's a disease to be infected with these abilities. And Ben views his exactly the same way. We get Electro. We get, I would guess he's supposed to be Molten Man. And then we also get Tombstone as well as the Sandman. And those characters are given just as much time as the other supporting characters to outline in this series that they're just not maniacal villains for the sake of. We humanize most of these characters. Of course, you have to present just straight villains, which is what Silvermane is, as well as Winston, his second in command. And this show's version of Electro might be the most annoying we've ever seen in any media, quite frankly. The way that they use that character where you just hate him and his untimely, his timely demise really does fit in with wanting that character to no longer be there. You need a certain amount of villains, but ironically, one of the most hated Spider-Man live-action projects is Spider-Man 3 and the use of Sandman, having it be revealed that he was actually the one who was responsible for the death of Uncle Ben. And the use of Sandman in this series is much in line with that version that a lot of people would have been introduced to that character in. That's something that Sam Raimi really wanted to do with his villains, was humanize them and tell a story about an actual character and not just a terrible villain for the sake of being a villain. There's always a duality of their identity to some degree. And we get that with Flint Marko, who is presented as just stupid muscle, and his relationship with Kat Hardy, Felicia Hardy, who winds up becoming Ben's love interest by the second half of the series, as well as Lonnie, who's Tombstone, we see their history and the mystery around their entrapment, or I guess captive treatment, in the POW camp and what led to them getting their powers, what has made these dormant abilities come to fruition. And it was the investigation of a doctor whose son was also ailed with these superhuman abilities. It fits perfectly in terms of time. We live in a much different era in the way that superhero powers are presented. Of course, outside of, I would say, the X-Men, for the most part, when a character, whether that be an antagonist or protagonist, is given superhuman abilities, there is usually triumph to that. I am more than the average human. And the use of it in this show, where these are these dormant powers that are sort of manifesting because of emotional feelings, I guess those that goes hand in hand, but in terms of hyper emotions, anger and sorrow, and we see it as it's almost a virus within our characters coming out at the worst possible time and using those abilities for their own success because they're maligned from society for being these creatures that are beyond human, that are disgusting. We see that it's quite physically changing what they look like. Their appearance is no longer human. And because they are painted into this corner of criminality, that they choose to use their abilities for themselves, because coming back from the war and this being a commentary on what happened to veterans after World War II, that this is when the terminology for shell shock, which was obviously just PTSD, in the Depression, people were then just living in camps around buildings. People were losing everything that they loved, and all of their finances were gone because of the first real crash. And we get to see from Ben's perspective what's happening within New York. Silvermane, of course, being the mob boss that is running New York City, he quite frankly is a use of a billionaire, but not in a way where, again, this show feels inspired, but these events that are portrayed and shown within this series are reflective of what has happened throughout all of time. If you think that billionaires are the first, or nowadays, within the last 10 years, haven't been involved with the political landscape of it being a municipality, state, or province, or the country as a whole, you're just, I'm sorry, misinformed. History, for a reason, does have a tend to repeat itself. And Silvermane's emphasis on his control over the city, the near-death experience that he did have, which forces him to bring up his shackles, investigate what the rat is in his system, and eventually weed that out with the use of Ben Reilly. There's a lot of enjoyment to be had with seeing Nicolas Cage play Ben Reilly, somebody who was investigating Silvermane for his own purposes, but then also hired by Silvermane to find the exact same answer to an entirely different investigation. And the way that that weaves all of the main characters' stories together is really gratifying, because it's not just, here's one thing, here's the mystery of each episode. While there is some of that to some degree, this is a story over 8 episodes. We get to find out what was going on, who was involved with the assassination attempt of Silvermane that brings Kat into the picture. And we get to learn more about the other villains, the metas, the superhuman ability characters, as the first half goes along, thinking that that part of the story is done after Winston is framed by Ben as the person being responsible for the hit on his life. And then the second 4 episodes really pivot into looking at what is happening to New York with the mayoral race, as well as the superhuman villains, Sandman, Tombstone, and Electro, being enlisted by Silvermane to take control of the city in a way that they were never able to do before, which is through even more fear and having the physicality of those characters to take over New York, to bribe even more cops, to prevent prohibition, to fight the mayor, the Cat Hardy, who was actually in cahoots with the mayor to try to take down Silvermane. And we learn much more about the mystery of the origins of the POWs, and we even get to see Ben Reilly's origin, which is he was in fact actually at that same camp, not because he was a prisoner of war, but he was actually one of the soldiers who freed all those people. And one of the reasons he's so different from the other people that died and the 3 that we see feel ailed by their powers is he was actually bit by an actual man spider. The visuals in this show go absolutely for broke in a way that you're not going to see things in this show like anything you've ever seen before. Nick has talked about the physicality of actually being a human spider, a man spider, and what that would be. His performance as Ben Reilly dealing with his powers, as well as Spider-Noir when it is in fact him in the suit, just feels like a brand new interpretation of this character in only a way that Nick Cage could do it. And I love that so much because we get so much superhero content every single week. We just had Daredevil, into The Boys, into Invincible, into Punisher One Last Kill. But with Spider-Noir, we are given something that feels as if it's a time capsule that is faithful to so many elements of Spider-Man in so many different places. The exploration of a meta-human cure or a superhuman cure is not a necessarily new thing. Specifically within Spider-Man, though, it's usually focused on with things like the Lizard. And that storyline was integrated into Spectacular Spider-Man, which even though I've read a lot of Spider-Man comics, that was the first time that I'd seen it be the focus of part of the series story for the entire season, which is brought into this that Ben, because his powers don't present themselves like any other person, that he's actually the key in creating a cure. In Spectacular Spider-Man, they create something that's intended for the Lizard, and the fact that Ben is experimented on creating this cure, allowing him the opportunity to help the other men, but also removing his powers and dealing with the choice that I'm no longer going to be the spider, and the consequences of that are because I'm choosing to be happy, which in itself is such a selfish choice, and things we've seen from Spider-Man that at the end of the day, he's going to choose to do the right thing, and he still does do that. Giving Marco the last antidote so that Flint can be with Kat, being the hero that we are familiar with who he's going to be, but having an edge, and that's one of the benefits of this technically not being Peter Parker, is we get to see Ben Reilly the way that the show would write him in this time, in this era, through these experiences that are very canonically connected to Spider-Man in every form of media. Being the hero who rises up through all the challenges, he is in and out of a lot of different drunk stupors, but is still Spider-Man, being the hero that we know. And what I love so much about his relationship through this series, specifically with Janet, is the back and forth, the reveal that she did actually know the whole time, which I find quite funny because I don't think they were necessarily, at least Ben and Robbie, hiding it from her within the series, the way that they communicate, showing how fundamentally important Janet is to Ben Reilly's investigations. He's a capable individual. I like a lot of the mystery elements of this. There's something to be said for the detective noir storytelling, very successfully done in Jessica Jones, but that was much more of a modern interpretation, using the black and white nature of this visual medium, exploring a mystery in the way that you would do it in the 1930s. This is paced so much slower than any other superhero show you're going to watch definitely within this year and probably within the last 10 years. The method in which story is delivered, the way that seeds are planted, is much more methodical, and the way in which all of those things come to fruition is just as rewarding, but because the show understands the nature in which this story is being developed, you get it through one whole week, and the benefit is it's dropped all at once. So if you choose to watch the series episode after episode, you can do that. I happen to have watched all 8 episodes in one sitting, and it really does feel like a cinematic event on the small screen. It plays with the nature of this being a 1930s serial. The supporting cast, or not even supporting cast, the cameo appearances of random characters throughout the show's setting is really fun. There's something to be said with this being in black and white, but also high definition, that it feels as if you are sort of locked from any sort of modern sensibilities. The choice of production design, the way that these characters talk, the dynamics of all of the characters. I'm glad that they brought in somebody like Robbie Robertson to be a different point of view in 1930s New York, obviously the political and the social climate was incredibly different back then. And what we get from Lamar Morris, honestly, I feel like he's very much Winston, but much more professional in this series. Winston being somebody who is a journalist as opposed to a private investigator, which is what Ben is. But we get to see two competent men who are investigating or researching what could be the cause for these mysteries that are happening in New York as they are unfolding in front of them in very different ways. But the three of them working together as a tandem unit, with Robbie constantly trying to get back to the Daily Bugle, a place that he was fired from, dealing with somebody changing his article after he had presented something on the three victims of the POW camp being actually attacked by police, but then pitching it when it's actually printed that they were the bad guys, and that giving him the ability that he knows that this story is so important that he's going to be able to maintain his editorial freedom when delivering another story connected to that. I loved this show. It was a breath of fresh air from so many different series, specifically within even Spider-Man. One of the elements that I'm so much looking forward to with Spider-Man Brand New Day is it feels as if the origin or high school nature of Tom Holland's Spider-Man is gone. Of course, we know he's now in university, but we finally get to see Tom Holland as a Spider-Man that is much more familiar. But because this is in the MCU, we're going to see a Spider-Man we know of doing things in their own way. Because, of course, Tom Holland has separated himself from Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire. He's now an actual adult dealing with the aftermath of Spider-Man No Way Home. And Spider-Noir is a Spider-Man story that is going to scratch all of the itches of somebody who loves Spider-Man. Lifelong fans will be familiar with this, but the series takes the opportunity, because it is in its own pocket universe, to change things, to make the story worthwhile telling. Each character has a meaningful part of the season-long arc without just feeling like a caricature that would be injected into this time era. Of course, there is an exaggeration to so much of this, but that fits in line with what they're trying to deliver with this show. It's funny, it's heartwarming, and the fact that we wound up getting Nicolas Cage in a Spider-Man show, just watch it. Even if you only are interested because of Spider-Man Noir in Into the Spider-Verse, but if you're just a Nicolas Cage fan, I don't know why you would choose to miss out on this. I adored this show. I hope they make more, because I would love to see what this show's interpretation of other heroes was. Is the POW camp going to be sort of the Kryptonite baddies or the Central City explosion? There's a reason you could sort of explain why there are other villains. So I'm really hoping we get to see more from this, because my expectations were high, but they were exceeded when finally getting a chance to watch the show. Did you watch Spider-Noir? Make sure to let me know in the comments what you thought about it. But I've given all of my spoilery thoughts. Now let's jump to the film news of the week.
Tonight at 11.
Doom!
We're sitting on top of the story of the century here.
But that's not all, folks. Here's the real blockbuster. Brace yourselves. You might want to sit out.
And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
There's only really three things I want to talk about this week. The second is what feels like the most obvious if you followed any of the pre-production and even post-production on the Michael film, which was, after a massive box office success, which has only continued to make money, looks like it's probably going to finish its gross over $900 million, Lionsgate announced that a sequel is in development. Now, what will be very interesting with this piece of news is what they choose to cover, because, of course, the ending of the film had to be changed because of a non-disclosure agreement that the Jackson estate had signed with the family that was involved in the lawsuit or defamation in 1993. Are we going to get a story that builds to this is it? I don't really know what they're going to do. It would be shocking if everybody involved with the film isn't back. Graham King has said that Logan is working on the script. I think this is going to be one of those projects that is likely fast-tracked, given the incredible success of this. When it comes to biographical films or biopics, this is like Bohemian Rhapsody. This has become a commercial success that has surpassed its critical reception, which obviously I talked about with my review. I didn't think the film was great, but ultimately the public said that they didn't really care about what the review said, and so many people went to it and really enjoyed themselves and had an experience. A concert that happened to also be a very subtle, not, I shouldn't say it wasn't subtle, shallow story on Michael Jackson. So the fact that we're getting a sequel, not really surprising. It is very rare that biopics get sequels, but given the fact that this movie was reportedly already going to be 4 hours long before they cut it down to just over 2 hours, it's not necessarily shocking. Money, at the end of the day, speaks more than anything. Star Wars is not doing well. Mandalorian and Grogu had a box office drop of almost 70% between weekends. Now, if you're somebody who doesn't track box office, I don't necessarily think that's shocking. A lot of people don't. But in terms of how box office success works, typically for a blockbuster, you do not want to have a drop from week one to week two that's any higher than about 55%, because the way that math works, you're going to be grossing less and less week to week. Unfortunately for The Mandalorian and Grogu, it seems like most of the people who wanted to see it saw an opening week, which was $81 million domestically, dropping to 25. It's really unfortunate that the theatrical debut of The Mandalorian and Grogu is not having the legs that Star Wars films used to. It was always projected that this was going to be in line with something like Solo. I think at the end of the day, this shows that it's just not a part of the universe that people are excited about. Yes, you can take kids to this, but kids these days are much less invested in Star Wars as a brand. Having more and more content from the Star Wars universe has only diluted the cinematic event that it used to be. When you just make more and more, that is kind of inevitable. And it's unfortunate that that is the case. And the reason I bring this up is because it was announced that Mandalorian and Grogu has lost its IMAX screenings to Masters of the Universe. Now, if you're a longtime fan of this podcast, you know that I absolutely adored Masters of the Universe Revelation and Masters of the Universe Revolution, not the 80s series. I like the Kevin Smith one that was on Netflix. It made me a He-Man and MOTU fan because of the exploration of the characters and new animation, and it was just absolutely phenomenal. Travis Knight, who is the director behind Masters of the Universe, understands how to be faithful, but also telling something of a story that feels legitimate through our cinematic landscape now. Bumblebee was the best live-action Transformers film, and it seems that he has captured that magic because all of the early reviews say that this is a thoroughly entertaining film. And because of that, IMAX has decided to bring in Masters of the Universe. It is incredibly rare for a Star Wars film to get bumped out of IMAX. So if the box office drop wasn't enough, now being replaced by a franchise that is nowhere near the pop culture level of Star Wars, I think that says something about what IMAX is suspecting from Masters of the Universe. And I am so looking forward to that. If you've watched my trailer reactions, I love He-Man, and this seems to really be scratching the itch that is expected from an exploration of Eternia in live action. Last piece of news, we got our first look at Minecraft Squared, which is going to be the sequel to Minecraft. Jack Black is back, as well as Jason Momoa, and Kirsten Dunst is joining as Alex. Matt Berry is going to be in an unknown role, and Danielle Brooks and Jennifer Coolidge are returning. I did not like the Minecraft movie. I thought it was really unfortunate that a world of originality and creation is what we happen to get from the film at the end of the day. But that movie nearly made $1 billion, so what do I know? It will be very, very interesting and telling if a Minecraft movie squared is able to capture the pop culture phenomenon that the first movie was. Obviously, Minecraft is one of the biggest games of all time, but there was something about the expectation and the anticipation of that film. I don't know. I think doubling down on what the first one was is not something I'm looking forward to. We got an example of that earlier this year with the Super Mario Galaxy movie, which obviously made a lot of money as well. So when it comes to delivering kids films or family-friendly films, it doesn't really seem to matter. I've said this over and over again that I feel like the bar has lowered from the expectation of families and kids, and that if it's just overstimulization for an hour and a half, that seems to be good enough nowadays. I would hope that Jared Hess and Chris Galletta take the criticism that the first one had levied fairly towards it and write a more compelling narrative, but if I were a betting man, I would probably say no. So we'll see, but that is it for news of the week. Now let's check out listener mail and question of the week responses.
Can I ask you a question?
Just one?
There's something I really need to ask you.
I ask the questions, you answer the questions.
Why do you ask questions to which you already know the answers?
Did that count as a question?
Yes.
Damn it.
Last week's question of the week was, if you could get another project from a Spider-Verse character, who would you like it to be? Scotty Cameron writes in, this has to do with something else, and then we get to his question of the week responses. Certainly not the worst Star Wars movie ever made, so he's of course referring to Mandalorian and Grogu. That distinction forever belongs to Phantom Menace. No, Scotty, I wholeheartedly disagree with that. The worst Star Wars movie is actually, funnily enough, not live action. It's the Star Wars Clone Wars movie, which is actually just a couple episodes. If we're actually only talking about live action, it's Star Wars Attack of the Clones. That movie is absolutely atrocious. It's the worst things that the prequels gave us. If I were to rank the three, it would be Revenge of the Sith is the best, just barely, Phantom Menace, and then Attack of the Clones. I completely disagree with Phantom Menace being the worst Star Wars movie ever made. And you have here at least until M. Night Shyamalan directs a Star Wars movie. Oh my goodness. Starring Steven Seagal. I'm slightly upset you even put that into the universe, Scotty Cameron. Why would you do that to us at all? And then his answer. A Spider-Man I'd like to see get a project would be Spider-Man 2099, because I just love the idea of cyberpunk Spider-Man featuring the public eye. I'd also love the use of other 2099 projects like Punisher. I'd also want Punisher Noir spinoff of Spider-Man Noir. Blasted Sony and your share of Spider-Man. It is funny, because watching Spider-Noir, I think, why didn't you make other projects with those characters? This is a great example of what you could have done with the goodwill you created from Into and Across the Spider-Verse. I have said this, and I will say this time after time after time. Even if Beyond the Spider-Verse is just fine, which it won't be, I have all the faith in the world in those writers and those directors and Phil Lord as producers, as well as the cast and all of the countless praised animators, because they are at the end of it, the heart of those stories. It will be the best, maybe trilogy of all time. It'll be the best superhero trilogy. That even won't be a debate whatsoever, but I'm mad that we got the Spum universe when we could have been getting things like Spider-Noir. Like, why, Sony? Why? Dylan Pollock writes in, I'd like to see Spider-Punk a lot, but don't know if he can sustain a series. I think Spider-Gwen is probably the best way to go, but I would also be worried about, but I also wouldn't mind seeing a Moonbatten or solo Spider-Man 2099 thing, or just Spider-Ham in a silly cartoon, more spiders. That, Dylan, is exactly the kind of point that I'm talking about. They created so many compelling characters and interesting people with unique worlds that visually help separate themselves from other things we've seen. You could almost just do an anthology series if you really wanted to, like what we've gotten from Tales of the Jedi, Tales of the Sith, Bad Batch, which is a phenomenal Star Wars series. I want more Spider-Verse if this is the bar for all of those things that have to clear it. Thank you to everybody who submitted their answer for question of the week. To respond, you can email the podcast, filmrealistpod@gmail.com. You can comment below directly on YouTube and Spotify, or you can hashtag QOTW on any of the Film Realist social medias. This week's question of the week is very simple. What 80s cartoon that hasn't had a live action film would you like to see get one? So there are some examples. Obviously, the biggest ones have had some, but for the most part, they've not been very good. Is there an 80s cartoon that maybe gets less credit that would be incredibly cinematic on the big screen? I'm very curious to see what people want to say. I'm a millennial, so I'm really looking at the Gen X's to help me out with this one. If you are watching this on YouTube, please like and subscribe. It helps the podcast get onto more people's home pages and just helps the podcast grow. If you are listening on your preferred podcast platform, follow so you don't miss next week's episode, which will be a review of Masters of the Universe. I'm very excited. I'm hoping to see that Travis Knight continues to have the power. My name is Kyle Naranja. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you next time.